Hi.
Hello.
For many years, when I was at Stanford's medical school, we used to do workshops on cardiovascular disease prevention. And it was a multifactorial workshop with all these people. You know, some people would talk about statin drugs and, you know, lowering blood pressure and enhancing compliance with all sorts of things. And I was the stress management person. And I remember that they used to give me always the right after lunch spot. And it took me a few times to realize, like, that's not the best moment for breathing practices because everybody's full. And I asked the coordinator, like, why do I always get the after lunch slot? And the woman said to me, well, we figured you had a better chance of keeping people awake than the lipid slides. And I remember thinking, boy, that's a high bar. No kidding. Like, I'm more entertaining than lipid slides? Oh, my Lord. But that has never left me. Every time I come in and talk after lunch, I think of lipid slides. And I'd love to do a double-blind experiment, you know what I mean? Like, I yak, and then in another condition, they put up lipid slides, and you get to see which engenders the most wakefulness. It's a funny moment. One other time, I was going to one of these talks. They were held right around Stanford. We did lots of them. People flew in from all around the country, like cardiovascular rehab teams mostly. And there was going to be one of them at the Hotel Sofitel in Redwood City. And I was late getting to the site, and I was stuck in traffic in Woodside, you know, just a little town right off 280. And I was getting tense because, you know, you don't want to walk in as the stress management person, like, completely frazzled and, you know, late and looking like an idiot and stuff like that. And I was starting to get, like, agitated. And there's a big, like, truck in front of me, filthy truck. But on the truck was written, truck empty, driver loaded. So that calmed me down, and I walked in, and it was fine. Truck empty, driver loaded. Okay. So what do I want to talk about? I'm actually thinking of what I want to talk about, because it's a very different energy after lunch. It's much harder to go into people's hearts. Your body is busy digesting. You've been more worldly, usually, conversation and eating and stuff, and so it's a different space. When I start in the morning, it's almost always like, you know, straight for open-heartedness. Like, how can I remind people to just be kind? It's usually a little different in the afternoon because, again, we're pulled, generally a little more tired, and it's just an interesting thing. So what I would like to start with is just a question. And the question is, for you, like, why don't you forgive? Like, just, like, why don't you? Like, why would you need to come here? Yeah, you could save.
If you knew my mother.
Yeah, exactly.
You'd know the answer to that question.
Exactly. You could save $100, you know what I'm saying? You could have a nice Sunday outside. But why don't you forgive? And if you look honestly, it's not attractive. It's not attractive. It's not. Because the first level of looking is what Rick just did. Like, if you knew my mother, or my mother-in-law,
or my father.
Or, again, all the ex-husbands from hell. I once gave a talk at a Christian retreat center where I was talking for less than 5 minutes about forgiveness, when three women jumped up to argue with the idea of forgiveness? This is with Jesus hanging every 20 feet. I swear, there were life-size figures of Jesus hanging on the cross every 20 feet around the room, and somebody jumps up to ask me why they should forgive. This is
because you're Jewish, right?
Because
I'm
Jewish.
The relevance here.
Yeah, exactly. I'm Jewish. You know, what do I know? But I'm just laughing at these all these hanging figurines of Jesus, and you know they're like one. So these women jump up with their ex-husbands from hell, and they ask, "So why should I forgive this bastard?" Seriously, after about 5 minutes. But if while I'm yakking, you're actually thinking about why you don't, it's not pretty. It's not. It's based upon like some idea that other people should suffer, that you don't mind if other people suffer, that you're totally wrapped up in your own experience, that it takes hard work, that maybe you don't know how and you didn't want to put the effort forth to find out. Or some of the other ones, which is you don't want responsibility for your life, you'd rather have someone to blame. Or you love the secondary gain of having an enemy or a problem to exploit. But why we don't forgive is generally not that attractive, and the way that we get around it is by telling our story. The way we get around looking at us is by having a story to tell about my mother or the ex-spouse or grandma or the United States Air Force or whatever it is. We have a story. And that story serves often as a shield to keep us from seeing ourselves. You know, if I can only remind everybody, including myself, how bad it was or how unfair it was, or how unkind it was, or how difficult it was, then I don't have to see me and own what it is that I'm doing. And like it's interesting, I have never a concern. Like when people are in my classes and I ask them why they're not forgiving, and they say very simply, "I think the bastard should rot in hell." Okay, like what am I going to do? But it's when people are less honest and try to make it seem that it's in the offense, not in them. It's very interesting. They try very hard to make it seem that the problem lies in the offense, not in them. And one of the things that I have found, I mean, this is just me teaching on a little more theoretical level because it's right after lunch, is you have to be very careful to separate the process from the content. The content is what happened, the who, what, why, when, or where, and the process is how we hold it. And most of us use our content in a way to shield us from looking at our process. Like, I'm either somebody who likes to blame, or I'm somebody who doesn't like to take responsibility, or I'm somebody who really doesn't mind if other people suffer. As long as they did me harm, what do I care? They did it. I'm not even arguing with any of these as answers. I'm not trying to make them right or wrong. I'm just saying these are the deeper reasons why we don't do it. And yet when asked or probed, we bring up the content. Why didn't you forgive him? Because they lied. Why didn't you forgive him? Because he cheated on me. Why didn't you forgive him? Blah, 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 blah. Now, one of the things that I have seen is the process is actually somewhat easier to work with than the content. Because how do I have no idea whether the content is true or not. Most of the time, it's somewhat true. You know, it's not entirely true, but it's somewhat true. Usually, people were badly treated. But the process of the way they hold it is an easier thing to get at. So it can be a question, you know, like, okay, I've heard you, as a psychotherapist, I have asked this question. I've heard you bring up that story now 4 times. Do you think I don't get it? Like, what is it that I'm not understanding, and why would you need to repeat it? Those are process kind of questions. Why would you want to tell me that story again? This is one of, to me, the failures of psychotherapy often, is it to some degree a little bit re-traumatizes people by not reminding them of the all sorts of variety of other ways to tell stories, many of which are centered in kindness or compassion or patience or understanding or tolerance or just life happens. But what I'm getting at is the story is our entree into our process. Like, what tale have we made up to explain this to us? And I don't use that word made up lightly. I believe that we make up our stories to serve an end. They're not necessarily truthful recitations of exactly what happened. Because if they're truthful recitations, you know, as the Buddhists know, there's a million different things that cause something. You know, there's codependent arising. We pick out a couple and make believe that we've explained it. You know, my father was terrible to me because he wasn't loved as a child. Okay, that's a convenient explanation, and it may have some of the variance, but it certainly doesn't have it all. So the thing that is most intriguing, not the thing that's most intriguing to me, but one of the things I really find interesting is, why don't we experiment with different stories? Like, what is it that has human beings lock themselves into one storyline and then just tell it over and over and over again? Even to the point of, I've had people, you know, remind me that they've told me the story before. Like, you remember, I told you this 2 weeks ago. I'm thinking it wasn't interesting then, you know what I'm saying?
They're paying you money, right? Okay.
Not enough. I use the Donna system. One time, well, I'm not going to tell that story. but here's the teaching in this. Your unforgiveness is locked into place by your story. Your forgiveness is facilitated by a change in story. Ask yourself why you don't practice different stories when you're stuck. I'm not asking for any answer. I'm just asking for an inner question. Why don't you practice different stories? It's the simplest intervention that human beings have created, is try something else. Try something else. And it's amazing. Once we ask people to tell a slightly different story, a lot of the edifice of what they've been holding crumbles. Because they have gotten so used to one idiosyncratic way of looking at a situation. My mother did this to me when I was blah, blah, blah. I did that. I remember I had this storyline about my mother from 7th grade. And I was 35 years old, so that was 20-something years later, before I ever checked out whether it was true. But I remember having this story to tell people of why I wasn't doing something well in my life. And the story that I came up with was my mother put too much pressure on me to succeed when I was 12. Okay? And I'm 35. I should have been dubious right there. But I remember telling many, many, many people that my mother, I came home from like 7th grade and got like a 90 on a final, and she asked me why I didn't do better. Okay? And I remember saying to other people, and probably to myself, and that's the reason why I'm not fully invested or something. Well, when I was 35, I checked it out with my mother, and she swears it didn't happen. Now, that doesn't make her right either, but what I'm getting at is we create grievance stories. Once we have created a grievance story, it becomes very difficult to alter because the grievance story becomes part of who we think we are. I'm the person who was harmed by. The effect was, because I've told it so many times, it seems true. It's a truth, not the truth. And one of the great ways to practice forgiveness is practicing alternative truths. Not to get locked into a truth that we misinterpret as the truth, such as my father was a terrible person who beat me, or I had a bad childhood. That's a truth. Another truth is I had a difficult childhood, and therefore, how do I learn how to be a successful adult is a whole separate truth that's as true as I had a difficult childhood that ruined my life. They're alternate truths. If you tell the truth of I had a terrible childhood that ruined my life, then you literally lock yourself in. It's one truth. There are a million truths. There is the truth of my poor parents, unable to love. What a wasted life. How sad. That's true also. Or poor me, I didn't get a chance to experience many of the things that other children got to experience. How sad. Or for whatever reason, I was given these experiences and I don't have a clue why. It may be karma. Maybe I deserved every single thing that happened to me. Maybe it's chance. Who knows? I don't know. But I could explore that as a story. What's this about? Is there reason for these? Are these wounds, are they going to come to us no matter what? Or is it random? Is it an accident? Did I play a part in it? I don't know. But even in my telling in this 5 minutes, I've given you five different stories. The minute you realize your story is relative, you're somewhat free to tell whatever story you want. And you can tell very healing stories. It's amazing what people can do. And they can choose kindness. It's remarkable. Once you realize your story is relative, you can choose kindness as an adult today, no matter how you were treated at 8. That is the freedom that we all have, is to invent, practice, probably the best word is experiment with different stories. Experiment with different stories. See what comes. See whether some stories are healthier than others. See whether some lead to peace and some lead to agitation. See whether some stories create a sense of connectedness, some create isolation. See whether some stories are empowering and some are disempowering. So much freedom that we don't take. And yet we tell the story, the grievance story, over and over. And then make believe, this is the other piece, that we're being rewounded because we're telling the story again. Now, again, I never argue with content because I don't know anything about people's content. I mostly accept it at face value because how would I know and why would I want them to believe that I don't trust their story? What I'm concerned about is how they tell their story. You know, the Buddhists use skillful. Is the storytelling skillful to a healthy and happy life? That's the real question I would like any of you who are holding on to grievances to ask yourself. Is the way that I have tended to language this experience one that would lead most people to a good experience? If it's filled with piss and vinegar, it probably isn't. If it, you know, if the very thinking about it, you know, makes your neck like this and your fists clench, it's probably not that helpful. You know, unless, of course, you want to keep psychotherapists and acupuncturists and chiropractors in business, which may be your service. You know, it could be. We all have our role to play. But what I'm getting at and poking at is, please understand, you have so much more cognitive and language freedom than you would have ever thought, and can change a story immediately in mid-story. Uh-oh, I'm going down the road of demagoguing my father again. I don't want to do that. He's just a human being who may not have been the kind of parent I wanted. End of story. That's it. He's just a human being who may not have been the kind of parent that I wanted. Done. Now, that doesn't mean that at some point you need to grieve your wound. Yeah. But grieving the wound and endlessly repeating it are entirely different. I remember once I was asked by Time magazine, this is on, let's say, October 11th of 2001, I was asked if America was ready to forgive Osama bin Laden. This was a month after the attacks on the World Trade Center. And I remember telling the woman that I wasn't sure that I was really ready to forgive her for such a silly question. But I could kid with her because she had no wounds. I said, you have to be kidding, right? We're still at the shock stage. Like, we were just attacked a month ago. So again, I'm repeating what I repeated this morning, is time is essential to this experience. And you're going to hurt when you're wounded. But had she called October 11th, 2006, I would have said, yeah, we're ready to forgive. And maybe had she called October 11th, 2004, I might have said that. Yes. I don't know, depending on how close people were to the horror. However, there comes a point where the story itself, our crafting of its particulars, actually becomes our problem, not what happened to us. That becomes our issue, is I have created a story around this that imprisons me and limits my freedom and causes my blood pressure to rise every time I tell it, and causes my nervous system to become agitated every time I tell it, and causes me to feel helpless every time I tell it, and causes me to become disempowered every time I tell it. That becomes our problem. That's the central work of the Forgiveness Project, is reminding people that the problem was not the past, but the active construction of it in the present. What are you saying to yourself? How do you hold the wound? With gentleness, kindness, or harshness? What do you think should happen to people who create wounds? These are all the present-centered experiences that we are originating an experience, not just responding to it. Because at any moment it can shift. I remember when I was developing the Forgiveness Project, and it emerged because a very close friend of mine hurt me very deeply. That this work all emerged because one of my closest friends abandoned me with no notice or reason, and it was absolutely devastating to me. It was truly devastating. And I suffered very deeply for a number of years and had no skills for handling this. Tried all the normal things like getting mad and feeling sorry for myself and telling everybody what a terrible person he was and trying to make myself feel better by cutting off his legs, you know, all that stuff. And none of those helped. I tried them all. I did. I tried them all. And I even, like, you know, tried a therapist letter, you know, using iMessages and all that stuff, which the research is doesn't work, which is unfortunate but true, because the nonverbal communication is so much greater. But tried all the stuff that didn't work, and then was so frustrated with myself and the situation that I almost like imploded until I came to the fact, well, just let it go and just move on. and decide not to go there again. You know, don't go back to there's something wrong with him. And so in the middle of telling people this well-rehearsed story of how there was something wrong with him, I'd catch myself and I'd stop. It was a little awkward, but it was a little awkward, right?
So having heard, you know, Fred's teaching, and I have basically a comment, and which is kind of a question in it, which you all may have some piece of this as well. The first part is that it's helped me to understand the meaning of forgiveness in a sense two levels. The traditional form of forgiveness, often the one we're taught in a religious environment, is where we in effect absolve the other of their guilt. We absolve them of their crime. We have them do something maybe, and then they're free. It's done. We give them a full pardon, as it were. That's one kind of forgiveness, to be sure. The kind, and it helped me to finally to understand the kind that Fred, I think, has largely, if not entirely, spoken of, is a different kind of forgiveness. Or I think if that's level two, where we really absolve them of their guilt and give them a pass and we move on, level one is where internally we may still reserve the moral view that what they did was wrong, unskillful, miserable, murderous, theft, molestation, drunk driving, what have you, flying airplanes into skyscrapers and killing lots of people. We don't give them a pass in that regard, but we come to peace about it. See the distinction? That distinction really helped me. Okay, because I think there are a lot of people that they're either not ready to, or frankly, they just don't think it's appropriate to take the stance that the other person is just, you know, absolved of that as a moral wrongdoing, but at least we can do level one of coming to peace with it for ourselves. So I wanted to ask Fred, what do you do if your genuine and considered view is that a thing happened or a complex set of things happened that really did happen, that drunk driver really did cripple your child for life? You know, the creepy person in your childhood really did molest you, right? Or your child, right? Or those people out there have really done various things to the environment, to the planet, whatever you really think are problematic. Even if it's your story about it is fairly accurate, yes, it does take into account a complex set of causes, but at the end of the day, yeah, they were drunk, they drove through the crosswalk and they killed your kid. All right. So if you can see the story or the account or the truth as it sits, knowing you can't ever know all of it, how can you then be at peace with it? It did happen, that is what happened, and I can be at peace that that is what happened. So how do you see that part?
I mean, my thinking now is that we have to be cautious with going beyond the fact that we think it was wrong. That
take the real case though. They molested the kid.
I have thousands of cases.
Yeah, yeah.
So
okay.
That since these kind of experiences happen so often on this planet, it's hard for us to know that they're wrong. That it's like saying that the thorn on the rose bush is wrong. That maybe from our point of view of wanting not to have pain of a certain kind, we make part of life wrong. That's our doing. There has never been a time on this planet where people didn't do all the difficult things that they're doing now, and there's never been a culture where they don't do those. And the same thing with natural disasters and accidents and stuff like that. Like, this has always been a part of human experience. And so I can say within myself that I don't think it was right, from my point of view, to lie to me. But since lying happens everywhere, I then have a very dicey decision to make. Do I get mad at every single person who lies, which is basically the whole planet? Or do I just narcissistically focus on the lie that affected me, which is what the problem is I have with Rick's question, which is people are not doing anything more than reacting within their own self needs and making that self need huge to encompass a planet where this stuff happens so often that it would be very difficult for any of us to say that it's wrong. More than likely, we are challenged by these things to figure out how to do something differently or how to respond in a way that may be more skillful or more kind or more gracious or whatever it is. But events that happen that often, and when we only react to them because they happen to us, it is very hard for me to see beyond just my opinion that I didn't want this to happen. Now, that said, in terms of my definition of forgiveness, it involves the personal point of view that what happened was unwanted or wrong within my ethics system. That's how I hold it. That, however, doesn't have reach beyond me. This is my ethics system. It obviously wasn't the same as the ethics of the person who did it, because otherwise they wouldn't have done it. And it's obviously not of the ethics of me when I do things that other people don't like, and their ethics are violated by me. So to me, there is such a deeper question of how do we exist in a world when we are each and every one of us almost relentlessly disappointing each other and not being loving enough and making mistakes and doing things that can be perceived as unkind. You could have a very lonely person and be totally wrapped up in your head and walk right by them, and they were aching for our attention. To them, that's wrong. When we come home from a day's work and don't have energy for our partner, at some level, that's wrong, that the partner feels neglected and rejected and can start this and create an argument. No, there is endless human interaction between what I want and what I got, and where do my expectations have a boundary? And I think we need to put some boundary on what it is we can legitimately expect from this world when what we want is to not suffer, even though suffering is everywhere. So maybe the particular flavor doesn't feel right, and it's awful. So the drunk driver is a horrible form of suffering. And, you know, the abusive parent is a horrible form of suffering. And, you know, political imprisonment is a horrible form of suffering. But there's so many of them. I mean, there's an endless array. Diseases, mistakes, you know, old age. I mean, this is the essence of Buddhism. You're going to suffer. So then the question is, like, how do we forgive, at least from my answer, the way the game is set up? And I think that's the tough thing for everyone, because we're all stuck in a game of some kind where we don't have a certain kind of control. And that helplessness drives us nuts. It does. That vulnerability and helplessness, that the fact that a drunk driver can kill somebody I love and there's nothing I can do about it is excruciating. It is excruciating. And the fact that a disease can strike somebody or a doctor can make a mistake is painful, is horrifying at some level, but it's all true. And so, again, my answer is always look at life, not just your own piece of it. And really ask yourself, is my piece that different and unique? And if it's not, then be careful with the excitation and reactivity. Now, that's 90% of the answer. The other 10% of the answer, which is questions like that don't have enough heart in them to me. The other 10% of the answer is, if I don't like it so much, please provide kindness back so there's less suffering caused by me. If what I really like is human, it can't stand is human insensitivity, human selfishness, human frailty, that let me not contribute any more to it by creating resentment or being bitter. That's the heart piece that's missing from those kind of questions of it really happened and it was awful. Well, if being hurt and mistreated is awful to us and there was enough heart in there, then we would do our best to respond not to reciprocate in any way that even resembles that. And so, again, these are hard questions, but the answers, again, as with everything on the spiritual path, involves some level of detaching our personality a tiny bit from it, realizing the universality of things, and then making some decision about how we want to behave in a world that can be painful and difficult. That you don't want your behavior just to be totally linked to events that might be difficult. You have the capacity to make some choice that's separate from that length. Was that too long an answer? I'm going to shut up because obviously you can tell I've thought about this. Yeah. All right, you had enough. Let me go to a practice about a story. Let me give you the simplest story practice that can help shift a little bit. And this is add some gratitude to the end of a story of complaint. And it is just the simplest thing that we have found to soothe people's nervous systems, to quiet them down a little bit, and just to show that you can change any single story at any moment. So what I'd like you to do is find a partner and tell a minute, 2 minutes at the most, of some pain that you've experienced. And then before you're done, add some and I'm aware of or I still see this beauty or goodness in my life. That even though I had a bad childhood, I have a partner who tries to love me. Even though I had a bad childhood, I have material abundance that allows me to come and do something like this. Or even though I had a bad childhood, I have a mind that's capable of working through some of this. It doesn't matter what the content is. But if we can teach people reasonably early on to quiet down the arousal of the grievance story and stay a little more stable by never arguing with the grievance story, which is, yeah, I had a terrible childhood where I was very badly treated, and right now I have people who try to love me. They're both true. But when you act as if only the grievance is true, then the blood pressure rises and all sorts of changes occur, and the memory stores access that, and that's not necessary. And I will never say anything to talk anybody out of the content of their story. But there's all sorts of stuff we can do around it so it doesn't imprison us. So I'd like you to find a partner, and I'd like you to tell like 2 minutes max of some pain, but add a legitimate gratitude, beauty, positiveness to it that softens the whole thing. Okay? Thank you. Okay, everyone. You know, Rick, what this is pointing out. Hello, everyone. I'm gonna do just a few moments of meditation, and I'll do a practice that will open just a little bit to another way to change that story. And so I'd like everybody to close their eyes. Just and just take 3-4 breaths into and out of your belly. And then just open again your heart to love or goodness. Just open an image of love or goodness or positiveness or care. Just open. And bring that image front and center and make it warm and see if you can feel it in your heart. And just see if that can quiet you just a little. And then just into that heart space, just think of, we're just going to do a guided practice, just think of a relationship, an intimate relationship that you had that didn't end the way you would have hoped. And it could have ended too early or too late or too quickly or too harshly or when you weren't ready, or, you know, an affair, whatever it is, just picture an intimate relationship of yours whose ending was not the way you would have hoped. And just sit with it for a moment and notice, you know, the experience of ending. And then I want you to ask, just inside of you, whatever your heart can offer, why were you in that relationship? What was your goal? Like, what did you want that had you in that relationship? What's the most positive way of you languaging what you wanted out of that experience? Like, why did you put yourself there? Only positive terms. Like, not that you didn't want to be alone or whatever it is, but what was your most positive motivation for being there? And then just sit with that again for another few seconds of, I was in this because I wanted love or connection or care or create a family or share experiences or whatever. Just sit with the positiveness of your own desire. And then let that go. Return your attention to your belly in a breath or two and allow your eyes to open. Now that little simple practice is just the easiest way that we have found to introduce people to the idea of positive intention. Like, what did you want? And one of the things that we have found for shifting grievance stories is often to ask people, like, what were you there for? And do you still want what you were there for? So one of the experiments that we do is we have people talk about their long-term desire for love. And then the lover that lied becomes a small piece in their story instead of the central character. So instead of coming in and raging about the ex-husband from hell, we suggest that people talk about their almost yearning for a partner from as long as they can remember, a number of relationships, some worked, some didn't, and then honestly discussing the truth and sadness of loss rather than centering it on the enemy. My husband, ex-husband's a bum. Because the love is deeper, the desire for love is deeper than any specific manifestation of it. And so we will ask people to very simply talk about you and love, rather than just what's wrong with your ex or how they misled you or any of that stuff, and then fit this in where it belongs, which is it's a piece. And then do you still want love? Is there a future beyond this? We'll talk about that too. That transforms the story from a grievance story to something much more truthful about them and who they are and what they want. And immediately, it's not that it goes directly to forgiveness, but boy, the blood pressure goes down. And that story to me is a lot more accurate than trying to figure out what's wrong with a partner or trying to feel that I'm the victim of somebody. In part, we are often not always the victim of our desires and of our unskillful means of getting them satisfied. You know, we don't know what our partner's going to be like when we sign on with them. Right? We make the best choice, and sometimes we don't make the best choice at all, but we make a choice. Now, one of the most entertaining experiences that I've ever had as a teacher occurred during that practice, when I asked people, why were you in that relationship? There was about 35 people in the room, and 30 of them said, I was in there for love. Very sweet, you know, tender, it was nice. Two or three said, I was there for connection. One was there, you know, because I wanted a partnership. And one woman in the back didn't say anything. We went out in the room, and I wrote them on the board, and one woman didn't say a thing. And I was intrigued by that. So I said, so yours wasn't among the list? She said, no. And I said, would you mind sharing with us what this response was? She said, of course. So she said, I thought of a relationship where I was there for great sex and cheese danishes. And then some guy over in the corner says, hey, I like cheese danishes. That was, I wish I could have scripted that. That was one of the great moments of my teaching experience.
And so what I'm getting at is this, because I'm going to be done in about 10 minutes, is no matter what it is that we think we're arguing with, we can put our heart back in it. Whether it's we tell our stories with a few moments of gratitude attached to it, or we open our hearts to find out what was our positive reason for being there, or maybe we try to tell a story that's full of compassion for our suffering rather than making an enemy out of anybody. I believe that that is another way of telling the truth. Like, I don't believe that the grievance story is the only truthful telling. I don't believe that simply saying, I was harmed by X, is the only truth that we have out there. I just don't believe that. When you do act that way, you create nervous system things that make it very hard to alter. You know, because adrenaline is not the easiest thing to exclude from the system every time you think about something or tell the story about it. It doesn't do the brain good in terms of full problem-solving abilities. It doesn't. So the more we can keep adrenaline out of our story, the better chance we actually have of it being true, rather than just a current-centered focus of stressful attention. And again, when we're hurt, proximate, you need present-centered focus on stressful attention. You have to. But looking back 3 years later, you don't at all. And so what I have introduced here just briefly is the fact that besides the stuff I talked about this morning, where you quiet yourself down and you give yourself a chance, there are all sorts of ways of bringing heart into our story that in and of itself transforms our relationship to the story. It just does. So if you think, well, I've told how wrong this was 100 times. So I have experienced all the nervous system learning that I'm going to get from that, which is how I see it. That we have nervous system learning from grievance, absolutely. I believe that over-practiced, it becomes detrimental to the human being. I believe it's a dead end after a while. It doesn't mean that it's wrong to be practiced the first 50 times. It's just that there comes a point where it's no longer useful. So when you start feeling that you're telling the same old story to the same old people or the same old story to your same old self, that's a good moment to try something else. And the easiest thing is to add, and boy, the next person you tell it to, just say thank you for listening. I really appreciate the care that you're showing by listening to this story of mine, and you will not create the same amount of adrenaline in you, and you will not have the same reactivity to the experience by simply adding, and thanks for being here, or it's amazing that even in such horror, people care. It just changes the way it's stored in memory, and it changes the way we relate to it. Then the other thing is you can change the story itself to always have an alternative point of view. There are many, many points of view. But as long as adrenaline's in your body, you won't want to, because you'll have stories that reflect basically fight or flight. And they'll be based upon something wrong happened and I have to get away or I have to defend myself or protect myself. And those stories are, to me, limiting when overtold. There's nothing wrong with them. They're just limiting when overtold. So again, think to yourself, if I was the most compassionate person in the world, what would I sound like talking about this? That's a great practice. Or if I wanted to tell this story without any like nervous system activation, what could I do? How would I relanguage it so I don't lie about it, but I don't get all aroused? Or how could I tell the story so my deepest truth, which is I want to be happy, becomes part of the story? Not what's wrong, not how the world let me down, not how it failed or any of that stuff, but I want to be happy. That's my deepest story. So I would have to tell a story of how do I use this pain and work through it so I can again be happy. Or you can ask yourself, how could I show my children to be a responsible, resilient adult through what happened to me? There's so many stories. Each of us can craft many of them, but when you don't, you're stuck. To me, that's what a victim is. Is somebody stuck in a rigid, one-dimensional story that they don't know how to get out of. that they don't have the key for opening up themselves to alternative points of view, none of which argue with the content. There's not one, you've heard me now for 3 hours or so, there's not one sense that I make anybody's story wrong in and of itself. It's the process of it can lead to things that I don't think are helpful for either them or the greater good. But the content we can leave alone. So you can even tell simple stories about, you know, how much pain you had and how you've learned to be resilient. And you don't need an enemy at all. That maybe it's as important a value to create resilience and compassion as it is to have a world free of suffering. I don't know, but that's my hypothesis. My hypothesis is this world is as screwed up so we can develop certain qualities. Otherwise, this is really nuts. It is. It's nuts. It's nuts. It's an insane asylum at some level, right? It is. The horror of it is immense. But maybe we're supposed to grow from it. And maybe we're supposed to dig deep to find meaning and some kindness within it. I prefer that. I don't know that it's true. I just prefer it. No, I do. You know, since I don't know, I might as well choose something that makes me feel better. Right? Because I don't know. So the last thing that I'm going to say is just a simple reminder is forgiveness is the active process of dealing more skillfully with no. It involves quieting down. It involves compassion. It involves taking things less seriously. It involves new stories. It's an active, present-centered process of showing resilience when you've been hurt. And the essence of this form of hurt is something happened that I didn't want to happen. And the deep pain for all of us comes because we're vulnerable to it. That as human beings, we know inside of ourselves how really scary this life is. And yet we do everything we can to not notice it until like a loved one gets on a plane and then you go, oh, I hope that lands. Or they go out and they're a few minutes late and you don't know what happened to them, or their cell phone rings and you don't get them. Everybody has that little, you know, because we know how much vulnerability there is. And I like to think that we're all dealing at some level with vulnerability management. That as human beings in a separate body that is defeatable, we all have so much risk. And sometimes we're pierced, and those are the things we don't forgive. Some of the things that get in that we can't protect ourselves from, where the vulnerability is, you know, is shown. I do not believe, and I've been doing this for 15 years, that making an enemy out of anybody in particular helps that much. Sometimes you do have to go to court and put somebody away. And sometimes you have to learn who to protect yourself from. I'm not advocating for anything less than that. You know, if somebody's an abuser, then you try to stop them. All my work is looking backward. It's looking backward from a point of view, this happened, now how do I hold it so that I move forward without bitterness and without a story that's going to cripple me? That's the forgiveness work. During the midst of it, you don't want to call me. You know, I could give you a little bit of help, but I'm more, you know, 6 months or a year down the road. Well, how do you want to turn around and look at it so you can have a life? That's what forgiveness is for.
Great.
Thank you all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.